You're listening to The Profile.
Welcome to The Profile podcast. God calls us to use our influence to share his love and goodness. For some, this is in leadership. I'm Andy Peck, and for the past 19 years, I've been interviewing Christians to find out how to lead better. Taking the initiative isn't always easy, so I hope you'll benefit from this latest conversation. The Profile podcast is brought to you by Premier Christianity magazine. Subscribe today and get full online access and the print magazine every month at premierchristianity.com.
It is said that it is the job of the leader to define reality for the people they lead. For the Christian leader, this will mean having a keen sense of the reality of God and his purposes, but also the world in which they live. And you will have noticed that the world in which we live in the West has changed and is changing. Premier Christian News has in recent years reflected the challenges that Christians face in seeking to be faithful for Christ at a time when Christian ideas are regarded as hostile. Maybe you are finding this yourself. So what do? Shrug our shoulders and hunker down until the second coming? Or do we do what Jesus asked us to do, to be salt and light where God has placed us? Well, Dr. David Landrum has taken a look at the cultural trends in a new book entitled Seismos, Christian Citizenship in a Post-Christian West. It is an alarming analysis of how things are, but thankfully finishes with a reminder of our role as leaders in the public sphere, emboldened by God to speak truth and live for him. And I'm delighted he joins me as my guest today, and I look forward to his insights into why we're here and where we need to go. So lovely to have you back on the Leadership Show, David.
Great to be here, Andy.
Been on before when working for the Evangelical Alliance, author of Seismos. The spelling, of course, is S-E-I-S-M-O-S. So why that title?
Well, seismos is a word that's used in the Bible to describe the storm that rose up when the disciples were crossing the Sea of Galilee with Jesus, who happened to be asleep in the back of the boat in the middle of this massive storm. And it's the word from which we get, you know, seismology and seismic, and it references to earthquake, the ground shaking. So it's not just a storm in a conventional sense. It's a storm in which everything that can be shaken is being shaken, as the book of Hebrews says. So that's the cultural context that we're in right now. Everything that can be shaken is being shaken.
So, Dave, in your book, you don't pull any punches in your analysis of the way in which secularism pervades society. Now, many of us grow up in a world where the Christian faith was seen as a good thing, even if people did not embrace it for themselves. Now many people see our faith as a hostile thing. And so the first half of the book provides many examples. How can you summarize what we're facing, Dave?
One of the reasons I focused on secularism in the book is because if you're not able to identify the main presenting cause or ideology or philosophy or however you want to put it, that's driving the changes that are affecting our citizenship and the place of Christians in the world, you can't identify that primary cause. You're never going to be able to do anything about it. You're not even going to be able to defend yourself against it. And secularism as an ideology, which is exactly what it is the presenting cause. And it's an ideology that purports to be neutral. You know, this idea, what we call in the book, the myth of secular neutrality, but isn't. It's a distinctive ideology that favors some groups and some ideas and disfavors other groups and other ideas. And it is intentionally, purposively, and comprehensively anti-Christian. It is also an ideology that is not democratic and is authoritarian in nature and trajectory. It can't help but trying to impose itself on everybody else. And secularism cannot exist alongside non-secularism. It must vanquish all enemy. It's what we call a totalizing creed. It covers everything and it must vanquish everything. So Christianity has got a fight on its hands. And if we don't understand the nature and the dynamics of this primary, this is the presenting issue of our day. This is the water we swim in. This is the panoply of ideas that are shaping our children, our societies, our communities, the values and morality of everyone around us, then we're really at a disadvantage. So a big push from the book, a big goal of the book is to help Christians to just see that thing, see that set of ideas that are pressing in and name it. If you can name it, you can control it, or you can at least resist it.
We can illustrate it, I guess, with some of our recent political leaders who've been Christians. You know, Kate Forbes standing for Parliament in Scotland, and she clearly was unashamed in her faith, but it was clear that her opponents could easily say, well, you're not being pleasant towards minorities or this and that.
One of the acronyms that's used in the book, and there's a few acronyms there to describe the situation, is Christianity is often described as WORIAD, WORIAD. Things are either worthy of respect in a democracy or not. Christianity is now seen as not worthy of respect in a democracy. So I use politics as an example of how our citizenship changes, because the degree to which a group or individuals have political voice or power is a really good test for where the state of things generally. So if you look at Christian engagement in politics, there are real Christians, as I would call them, and Wilberforce called them, across the different parties, but far less than they used to be, and they have far less legitimacy for their voice in policies, in politics, in parliaments, on policy, and even within the parties, well, especially within the parties. Kate Forbes is a good example. But so I give the examples of Tim Farron, what happened to him, and also what's happened to lots of Christians at a local level. Politics is a good litmus test for where things are in our society. And things have changed fundamentally and dramatically, and Christians need to understand that, acknowledge it, accept it, grasp the nettle, and seek God for what they need to do in this new context. It is absolutely what Os Guinness recently described as a civilizational moment. We are in a civilizational moment. This is no small thing. This is not just a few changes that will blow away. This is a big deal. And the book is written with 25 years experience in the policy field and in public theology. So it's a kind of summary of the trajectory we've been on, what it means, and where the book is landing, and where we're going, you know, the possible futures ahead for Christians from this intensely hostile secular context.
The fact that you need a book at all, Dave, hints at where you think the church might be. Mm-hmm. By and large, I guess Christians have been ignorant of what's been happening. Would that be fair?
Well, to a degree. I mean, a lot of Christians are bewildered by the pace and the scale of the change, and that's legitimate. I mean, things have changed probably more in the last 10 years than they have in the last 100 years. We're experiencing dramatic and rapid cultural change. It's what the former chief rabbi, Lord Jonathan Sacks, called cultural climate change, which I note in the book. It's a really good, another weather analogy that works quite well. And it's about the complete destruction of our social ecology and the transfer of one truth regime to another. And the problem Christians have got is we are the prior truth regime. So we are considered as enemies of the state, of society, of the culture at this moment in time. We're not just a minority at the margins. We're viewed with enmity. And Christians need to understand, it's a difficult thing to understand, because you see all the great gifts of Christianity in the culture. And there's so many gifts that we don't even recognize, like forgiveness and neighborliness and care for the elderly, care for the infirm, care for the young. These things seem automatic to us. They're not automatic. The world outside of Christianity and Christian history is a dark and dangerous place. They do not have them values in many parts of the world and throughout history. So what we're seeing in many ways is, as Christianity is pushed out of the culture, what was there before is returning. And we need to understand what that means for the gospel, for the Great Commission, and for the church as the body in the culture. And then, you know, there are different reactions to this. Some people are fearful of it. Some people are acquiescent of it. They are complicit in, they're basically secularized Christians, particularly a lot of leaders across the Western world. And many are just fearful. Some want to opt out of it altogether, which in past times you could probably do. You could probably go and live in a monastery and preserve the truths of your faith, but that's more difficult to do in an interconnected world and a world of heavy surveillance as well. So we've got to look soberly at the storm front that we're facing and not deny it and not try and diminish it in any way, but find the courage to look it square in the face and then think about how we get through this in the years and decades ahead.
Your book reminded me a little of Jeremiah, who said, they dress the wound of my people as though it were not serious. Peace, peace, they say, when there is no peace, Jeremiah 6:14. Do you feel like a prophet? Do you feel this is a prophetic word that you're giving?
I hope it is, but if anybody else, it's not for me to say whether I'm a prophet or whether I feel like a prophet. I think that's for other people to make a judgment on that. I've heard many prophetic words over the years about the nature and the spiritual change we're experiencing in many ways. And we've seen it as a sifting of the church. It's kind of, you know, it's differentiated the wheat from the chaff in many ways over the years. So, I mean, many Christians have just folded in with the culture, have become fully secularized instead of sort of subconsciously secularized. They've intentionally embraced the culture, but many haven't, and God always has a remnant. And the church, ironically and paradoxically, yeah, maybe Jeremiah in many ways, but I do see a more, particularly in the West as it pertains to the UK and Europe, a smaller church but a purer church. And I do think God can work with that. And I think there are exciting times ahead. There are so many people come to faith from basically atheism, paganism, and from other religions such as Islam and Hinduism. There's so many people come to faith in Christ right now in the middle of this very difficult context. And I think, you know, God values truth over peace. And I think we need to recapture that. That's a statement, I think, by the former Bishop of Liverpool, J.C. Ryle, that God values truth over peace. And if Christians can understand that and understand the fact that our faith does come with a cost. When we are authentically Christian in a fallen world, we are, in effect, countercultural. So that's life. We're going to get some brickbats for that. We're going to get some criticism, some marginalization, some discomfort. And if we can accept that, which Rod Dreher, who I draw on a lot in the book, calls the recapturing of a theology of suffering, if we can do that and accept that that is normal Christianity, then we've actually got a bright future. You know, so though it's Jeremiah, I do see a bright future ahead if the church can live distinctively and act strategically.
Dave, you mentioned Daniel and Joseph, the Old Testament Joseph, of course, and the little known Erastus, Romans 16, which people may be scurrying to their Bibles to find. These give us examples of how we might function in this world where you need public servants who are prepared to speak and be gracious within this environment and stand firm for Christ.
Yeah, they're all examples, and I quote many more in the book because I look at citizenship from a Christian and biblical perspective, and it's actually really important because it's one of those things that's explicitly mentioned in the book over and over and over again. God, you know, citizenship of heaven, citizenship of earth, that's the Augustine kind of division of things. But God calls us to be ambassadors of heaven on earth here. And whatever situation he's taken us into, we can be salt and light. We can be prophetic. It's interesting that those people that you mentioned, they operated in the supernatural. They were leaders who were shaped by dreams and visions. And we need that again, I think, in public life. You can't just operate on your own steam. You need the prophetic, because the prophetic for leaders is the edge that we have. And the book concludes with a strong emphasis on what I call public leadership. And we've talked about this before, Andy, the need for Christians to be intentionally leading and shaping change, often in a subversive way, in whichever culture, society, organization, company, place God has put them in. And that requires a mind shift in many ways, and it requires a mind shift back to a New Testament church mentality. If you think about what's written in 1 Corinthians 1:26, where Paul is writing, he says, "Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were first called. Not many of you were influential, not many of you were of noble birth, but God chose the foolish things of this world to confound the wise."
Wonderful, yeah. And towards the end of the book, you also say this, and this is quite stark. Things are much worse than most people understand. Things will get even worse before they get better. And things are never as bad as they seem with Jesus in the boat. So yeah. I like the last bit. Yeah, it's important to be realistic, I think, about where we're at and the need for people to stand up. But, of course, you know, God has been in the business of doing this throughout human history, and he will equip us and equip all those who seek to stand in this place.
He will equip us, and that is really my heart for the book. My passion for the book is to see God's people equipped to be able to understand the times and to know what to do. That is what this book is about. It doesn't pull any punches because I don't feel the need to. You know, when I worked in the various executive roles in the UK, I needed to qualify lots of what I said because you have to be careful and you have to be diplomatic. But I don't need to do that in this book, and that's what I've done. I've just told it as it is. It is a very, very difficult landscape, and if we can understand that and accept that, we'll be able to navigate it much more successfully and much more victoriously, ultimately.
Obviously, Dave, we're encouraging people to buy the book and reflect on it prayerfully. You will, as you've mentioned, Rod Dreher and others. Who are the voices that you've been particularly found helpful, who've been articulating this also?
Well, my old friend Oz Guinness is a real inspiration to me. He's written more books than, gosh, I can even count. And he's had his finger on the pulse of the culture for so many years and identifies correctly now the obvious and oblique presence of cultural Marxism on and in pretty much everything in the West, which is a intentionally destructive ideology. So Oz is really important. Rod Dreher, again, his book, Live Not By Lies, is an absolutely fascinating book in which he talks about soft authoritarianism, which is what we're in right now, and it may well get a lot harder for us in the years ahead. And, you know, there are others. There's a fascinating book I draw on by Stephen Smith called Christians and Pagans in the City, Culture Wars from the Tiber to the Potomac. Now, he's an anthropologist, really, but he's basically studying the fact that this has all happened before. And when we talk about secularism, what we're really talking about is a bridge to paganism, forms of neo-paganism. It's ironic that secularism is now completely indistinguishable from sexualism. Secularism and sexualism are the same thing. You can't tell one apart from the other. And that is a drift into paganism. What we're seeing is, and the book maps this out in great detail, a return to the cultural conditions that Paul describes in Romans 1. We're actually here in them right now. We're not returning to them. We are here. Now, the difference with today is Paul was writing in a pre-Christian age. He was writing about Rome before Christianity has happened. We are now in a post-Christian West. So what does that mean? It's really, really important for us to understand our place now in a Romans 1 context that is post-Christian. Things are returning to the way they were pre-Christian in many ways. I'm not saying that will happen wholesale across the civilization uniformly. There's actually a lot of positive things happening right now with the church across the West in all sorts of different ways. But if we don't acknowledge the scale of this challenge that we have, we will never be able to seize to take the opportunities that God will present to us and is presenting to us in the midst of it.
Dave, do you see Christians discussing this in public forums?
I do in various ways. I mean, it is profiling quite heavily in certain political and theological conversations. So I just I just got a book recently called Stockholm Syndrome Christianity, How Christian Leaders Have Failed. And it's about how they've been secularized, the symptoms, the causes, and the cures for that in the West. You see a lot more of these books coming out right now about how we need to audit ourselves for how secularly contaminated we are. So I do think there is a developing consciousness. And you look at the J.D. Vance speech recently in Munich, in which the vice president spoke to the gathered leaders of the European West and basically berated them for forgetting the basis upon which their civilization is built and the reason for which they might even fight to defend it. We have now, and we need to understand this, an entire elite strata of the entire civilization of Western society that hates Western society and hates the Christian root system of that Western society particularly. They don't dislike it. They don't tolerate it. They detest it. And every policy element that they do, every move that they do is designed for the destruction of that root system and the culture that it's built. And once you start seeing the world through that lens, it changes everything.
So you would encourage us to obviously stand up, to listen, to engage in conversation, to pray.
To pray and to think strategically. The book concludes with a section called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction, which is a quote of Eugene Peterson, the theologian, which actually he stole from Nietzsche. It was originally a quote from
Nietzsche. Oh, was it? Okay, I didn't realize.
Yeah, really. So, but what it means is the church needs to think strategically. Often we're, and this is a secularization of our minds, it's a microwave mindset. We think in months and weeks and years in terms of where we are in the culture and how we can affect things. We've got to start thinking in terms of decades and even centuries, because culture is, by definition, a really big, slow, messy thing. It's about views. It's about values. It doesn't change quickly. It changes really slow. It's like an oil tanker on the sea that you need to turn really, really slowly. So if we focus on developing Christian leaders that understand that and that can lead churches and Christian organizations with a longer-term vision to see the culture change, we will prevail, because I can tell you now, secularism cannot do that. It thinks about the self, me, now. It has no regard for future generations. So if we can start thinking together and start working together towards a longer term goal, we can move through and beyond this life in a negative world, as Aaron Wren puts it, into a better and more positive future. But it's going to take time. And that's another countercultural or counterintuitive way of thinking. We've got to start thinking more long-term and thinking about not just our children, our children's society, but our grandchildren's society.
Jesus spoke of, quotes, the man of peace. There will be those within the secular world who warm towards a Christian agenda and see something of the reality of what we're saying. They will spot what's going on, even if they're not believers themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I think over the last 10 years, particularly around the UK, which there is a vacuum of leadership in the church generally, there is some of the most prophetic voices have been non-Christians. I think of people like Douglas Murray.
Yes.
He's not a Christian, but he understands the times, and he's grasping at knowing what to do. And there are many others like that, some of whom have come to Christ, people like Russell Brand, and Ali Hersey. They're thinking their way to God because they're seeing the culture that they're in and the profound changes that we're seeing. We're not just seeing changes to ideas of how we should live our life now. The dominant debates are around what it means to be human. What is even a human? What is old? What is young? What is reality? What isn't? I mean, we're at a liminal point for human nature in many, many ways. And they see that, and they understand a quote that I use in the book by T.S. Eliot, that if Christianity goes, the whole culture goes. You lose everything. And they're kind of finding their way to God through this logical train of, oh my goodness, what's happening? And then they start to value, it's like Tom Holland, the historian, he began to understand the historical value of Christianity and everything that we have and the things that we take for granted every day. And that's what brought him to faith. He started to trace where these things come from, this book, this gospel, this Jesus. And that brought him to faith. So I would expect a lot more of that to be happening in the years ahead as people who've got a grain of truth in them find their way to the Lord.
Well, Dave, we just mentioned then again, the name of the book is Seismos, S-E-I-S-M-O-S, Christian Citizenship in a Post-Christian West. How do people get copies?
Just go on Amazon.
Amazon the place.
And grab yourself a copy there. It's on Kindle. It's on paperback. And brilliant. I hope you enjoy it. And my heart for this is to just, it's a hard book in the sense that it doesn't pull any punches, but I felt that was necessary because Christians really do need to understand the times that we're in and know what to do. And I hope that that just contributes to what God is doing in people's lives towards that end.
I'm sure it will do just that, Dave. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
It was super to chat with Dave Landrum, author of the book Seismos, Christian Citizenship in a Post-Christian West. It is a challenging read, but I would encourage you to get a copy and reflect on how it describes culture and where things have come from and where things are heading. And may God help you to assess how that impacts your current leadership, either in a church charity or in a commercial world or wherever God has placed you. May God help each of us to stand for him and speak when we can and as we can in order to further his purposes in our world. So this is Andy Peck. Thank you for your company and looking forward very much to the next time. Bye for now.
The Leadership Show with Andy Peck. To get in touch, email andy.peck@premier.org.uk.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.